Well, thanks, Dean. That was a lot of fun.
Good. Yep. I enjoy doing these kinds of chats because, in a sense, it keeps me sharp, and also it gives me a way of explaining things in simpler and simpler terms. When I give talks to technical audiences, of course, you have to retreat in a kind of a jargon. You're talking a lot about the statistics and all that stuff, but it doesn't really connect with most people. So I've tried over the years to figure out ways of talking about this in as accurate a way as I can, but not devolving into pure fiction. So that's the balance I try to maintain, and that's why a discussion like this is useful, because I usually presume that the people asking questions are not scientists, or even if they are scientists, they don't know about this particular area of science. So I try to make it simplified but accurate.
We find that people really have a hunger for this kind of meaning, that some kind of connection, but they want it in a non-threatening way, I guess.
Non-dogmatic.
Well, non-threatening. So, like movie Ghostbusters, all the information is there. It's
Right.
just it's fun. You know, if you can put it in some kind of space or box or something that.
That's what we were talking about with pure fiction. So on this, not I guess not this particular show, but how Douglas and I met was basically looking at fiction. So a lot of individuals after 9/11 started noticing that that there was a certain kind of theme happening over and over with the Twin Towers inside media before it actually happened. It also and there was the book written about the Titanic, for instance. Like 2 years before the Titanic actually happened, there was a book about an unsinkable ship named like the, what is it, Doug? Like the Titania or something like that. Something it
Titan.
absurdly close.
Yeah, it was Titan.
Yeah,
Yeah.
uncanny. And then Philip K. Dick had, so like when I mentioned thin filters, he's somebody who may have had pretty thin filters because he a lot got through.
Right. So, the intelligence agencies are very interested in the idea of mining the big data provided by things like Twitter for exactly the same reason that you mentioned, that if you find that little impressions and flits of imagination are happening in lots of people all at the same time, even though they're nominally disconnected, if you are paying attention to that, and you have millions of tweets going on all the time, it might be a way to mine the collective unconscious, essentially, and get a heads up that something big is on the way. So
So,
there are people paying attention to that in the apparatus that is designed to keep us all safe.
what do you think about random number generators?
Oh, I like them. They're very nice.
And
They're
so,
everyone should have one.
Where are you going with that, Will?
well, I mean, that's basically random number generators are the experience or the experiment on whether trying to break probability, and certain events seem to have an effect on multiple random number gen like 9/11. Some people say that like rent they basically beep, right? So if it just runs these random numbers over and over, and if it breaks probability, you can set the random number generator to light up. Or do you know what I'm talking about, Mr. Radin or Dr. Radin? I mean, have
Yes.
you? So am I explaining it correctly, or am I like a dupe here? Because.
Let's see. How do I describe? You're describing sort of correctly, but missing 50 years of underlying literature.
So this is a psychic phenomena alarm system that Will is setting up here.
Basically, well, yeah.
Well, no. I don't know how far back to give you the backstory on this to make it all make sense, but basically the notion started in 1935 that a gambler went to J.B. Rhine, who was at Duke University at the time and one of the fathers of modern psychic research. And the gambler said to Rhine that he could throw the dice and make them do what he wanted. So he was doing pretty well in gambling. Rhine said, "That's ridiculous. Prove it." So the guy took a pair of dice and started throwing them, and sure enough, he was able to get numbers that he was asking for. So from then until now, a huge number of experiments had looked at the role of intention in influencing probabilities of random events.
Right.
So first started with dice, and lots of targets have been used. And in the last 50 years, electronic circuits have been used. So those are the random number generators, the electronic circuits that do the equivalent of coin flipping. There's another reason, though, why these circuits are particularly interesting, especially in the last 50 years, and that has to do with interpretations of quantum mechanics. So to make an extremely long story short, the difference between classical and quantum mechanics is classical mechanics assumes that the outside world, the external world out there, it consists of separate objects which are not reactive at all to the act of being observed. In classical mechanics, that's no longer true. Both parts are no longer true. First of all, there's no external world, per se, and objects are sensitive to observation. So that's, as I said, we're jumping through decades of interpretations here, but because the quantum world is so much stranger and so reactive, apparently, to observation, the random number generators built for almost the past 50 years have all been based on quantum processes. Because the idea was that if you can observe a quanta, an individual quantum event, and that observation causes it to change its behavior, that if you created what amounts to a coin flipper, where the randomness was based on a quantum event, that maybe your act of observing the output of this generator would actually change the probabilities a little bit. It would no longer be 50-50, but maybe 49-51. And if that occurred, you'd be able to see it because you can generate a fair amount of data. You could use simple statistics to see that you, in fact, had manipulated the system. So there's a huge amount of data using these kinds of generators which show that that seems to be the case. If you wish for more ones, you get them, and you wish for more zeros, you get them also. So in probably the beginning of the 1990s, a colleague of mine at Princeton at the time, Roger Nelson, got the idea that maybe what's going on here is not intention. It's not reflecting will, but rather it's reflecting attention, simply the act of attending. And that makes sense from a quantum perspective, because in quantum mechanics, it's simply the act of observing that changes the behavior of a quanta. It's not willing an event to occur, but simply paying attention to it. Roger started doing experiments in things like meditation groups and compelling movies and festivals and things like that, where you can predict based on what was happening that a lot of people would be paying attention to the same thing at the same time. And that's like a coherence of attention when people who didn't even know that they were in an experiment. But you have a random number generator going, minds suddenly go into coherence, and the prediction would be that if attention alone is enough, just the presence of attention, that maybe the random generators would stop behaving randomly and start showing a kind of coherence. So that's what gave rise to what's now called the Global Consciousness Project, where there are 65 or so random generators around the world, and we either make a prediction about an upcoming event, like a big celebration or maybe the World Cup soccer, and make a prediction about this event will be big enough and have enough worldwide attention that maybe the randomness that we're measuring 24/7 around the world will become slightly less random during those periods. So as of now, there's something like 450 events that have been monitored, one including 9/11. Of course, 9/11 we couldn't predict. So in that case, what you do is after the event occurs, before you look at the data, you define the meaningful period of the event. So for 9/11, it was, I think something like 6 hours or so, a few hours before and a few hours after were considered the primary event. And then you look at the data using a standardized analysis, and what you find after looking at many, many events like this, that there accumulates to odds against chance of many, many trillions to one against chance, that in the direction of the world as reflected by the random generators becomes more ordered. There's more coherence in randomness than there should be by chance. That suggests to me that, just as lots of other experiments suggest, that our usual way of thinking about mind and matter as being very different types of things, they're actually not quite so different. They're, in other words, the usual dualistic, the everyday dualistic sense of mind and matter being different, very likely to not be correct. They're probably much more closely related to each other, I suspect, in the way that matter and energy and space and time are relationships. I think that mind and matter are a kind of relationship, two sides of the same coin. So that's my very, very short explanation about random number generators.
Okay, so another question I would like to ask you is if you were pessimistic or optimistic about the future of the human race.
That depends on how close in time it's been since I've read the last horrific apocalyptic.
So the last time you turned on the news, Mason.
Well, I get a news feed on trends of the future. Most of the trends are absolutely horrific. Earlier in July, about a month ago, I was in Australia talking to the leaders of Australia, the government leaders, military, business, and so on. About 130 people run Australia. It's the whole population of Australia is basically like the size of California. So, but it's, you know, it's a giant country and much more homogeneous than the United States. So it's possible for a small number of people to actually run an entire country. So they get together once a year and they talk about different themes. The theme this year was thinking the unthinkable. And basically it was a kind of review of events, any one of which could take civilization to a screeching halt. And after listening to a day and a half of this, I gave a talk. But before my talk came up, we were listening to all of these various scenarios. It's extremely depressing because any one of which is an extinction event. And the problem is that there are so many of them now, and unlike in the past, there are many events that could unravel. And I heard a term which I hadn't heard before, which is called threat multiplier. So you have multiple threats that are multiplying and interacting, and no one has any idea about what to do. So it's kind of an antidote to all that. My talk was on unthinkable thoughts about the mind, and basically saying that one of the strengths of the human species has been its extreme resilience and creativity in the face of horrific odds. And among the things that we're probably not taking advantage of is the fact that our minds are capable of much, much more than we're taught in our textbooks. And if we don't wake up to our actual potentials pretty soon, we are doomed. So my talk, as being one of the more positive ones, giving kind of a way out of this horrible mess we've gotten into, was very well received. And so, well, I thought, okay, did my job.
So then do you have a meditative or, you know, type of psyche, I don't want to say spiritual, but some kind of practice?
Yeah, I have a daily meditation practice. I do it not so much because I think I'm on the road to enlightenment, but because the health benefits, physical and mental health benefits, are so clear now from lots of scientific tests that I just think it's a good practice in the same way that brushing your teeth is a good practice. Mm. It's so beneficial and so easy compared to lots of other things you could do that why wouldn't you do it?
Is there a particular form of meditation that you practice?
I think probably the closest name for what I do is Vipassana.
And like
a kind of
mind.
And
you say it because you've kind of, you perhaps you've adapted it to your own style, or do you, is it kind of evolving?
I've tried many different methods over the years, and the one that seems to work for me best is kind of a mindfulness, I suppose. Mostly it's about paying attention to breathing. Whenever your mind wanders, you go back and pay attention to your breathing. It's really that simple.
And you do that for about 20 minutes? Or?
Yeah, I do it 20 minutes, and if I can manage, I do it twice a day for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So is there anything recently that you've seen while in the lab and you're just like, the people need to know about this? Like, how close are you to changing the world?
Probably not too close. No, my usual response to a similar question to the one you were asking there was people say, what's the most amazing psychic thing you've ever seen? And the answer is my career. And the reason is that there are roughly 30 to 40 people around the world who are trained scientists who are doing this kind of research. So that means that there's no career track, extremely little funding, very little support from any mainstream perspective, and a huge amount of pushback from the mainstream science community and even mainstream media. They don't like this at all.
No.
So the fact that I've been able to do this now for the majority of my professional career and be paid like scientists are paid is kind of a miracle. And I take it basically, I'm grateful every day that somehow the world or something has allowed this to happen. So I see myself as part of a long legacy of a very small number of people who have somehow managed to be able to do this. And will the world change quickly? No. The strangest thing about all this, though, is that it's very clear after a while that we're living in something like the Emperor's New Clothes. There's a taboo where there's certain things that are obvious, but you cannot talk about it in public. So to give an example, at this meeting with leaders in Australia, I never quite know what to expect when I'm talking to a bunch of people in authority, because maybe they're very skeptical, maybe they're not. I don't know how to calibrate it beforehand. But so far, what has happened in almost every case is I finish my talk and people are very polite, and then they kind of look around at each other and some wander off. But about half of the audience comes up and starts telling me their psychic stories.
Right.
And these are government ministers and the head of their defense intelligence agency and the head of their National Science Foundation and on and on and on. So the reason they were able to do this is because that particular meeting was held in an invitation-only private island. And so there were no press, nobody from the outside at all. And they designed it that way so people could be open and forthcoming about their comments. And so in that context, I've seen the same thing in the Navy, and I've seen it in other contexts. At very high levels, people are very, very interested in this, and they're not anywhere near as skeptical as you might imagine if you only read the scientific press.
That's so interesting.
It really is. And then if the paradigm does shift, I wonder, someone like Edgar Mitchell, when I heard you talk about him, it's the whole thing is just so fabulous. So here's an astronaut, he's on the moon, and then he comes back and says, I want to explore inner space.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
But
before we let you go, we have to know what you thought about Dan Brown's lost symbol, of course.
Well, that was a big surprise to us. We had no idea that he was going to use the Institute of Noetic Sciences in the book. We found out, like most other people found out, we got a call from someone who got an advanced copy and said, oh, look at this. You know, what did you do to help this? And our answer was, what are you talking about? We didn't know. So, I mean, it was useful in terms of getting a lot of people to pay attention to the idea that there actually can be a science about noetic experiences, but it was just as surprising to us as everyone else.
Okay, well,
I gotta go decompress.
It sure was fun sharing the time with you. We look forward to anything that you do. It's great. We're gonna have Dr. Kreipl back on in the fall in September because we need to talk about Esalen again.
Right.
It just seems like on our show we've looked at a lot of mystics, especially from the Crowley, Blavatsky, Manly mm-hmm. P. Hall era, and they're interesting, but there's something about California. There's just something about California that is just igniting me personally, like the idea of Esalen and American mysticism,
mm-hmm.
yeah. which we just talked about. What was this? Jack Parsons, another interesting guy. He's interested in all this occult stuff, but then at the same time he's developing rockets and rocketry mm-hmm. and advancing science in a really material way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my I'll end with my standard story about California. So we for one thing, when I was a teenager, I was living in Massachusetts. I somehow knew I was going to live in California. I didn't even know about California at the time. I didn't know anything about it, but I knew that it was going to end up here somehow. When we do studies now involving meditators, we often look for meditators because they tend to do better in these experiments. In one study, we were looking for meditators who had an active practice of at least 25 years daily, which makes them in an advanced category. Of a particular type of meditation called non-dual, where they basically lose every distinction in the process of meditating. There's no here and there and me and you and all that. It goes away. Well, when we do that, this was a neuroscience experiment, so we had to find matched controls, age and gender matched controls, who had never meditated. So where I live, it's easy to find very long-term meditators. It's very difficult to find people who have never meditated. So it's kind of a reverse of what you might imagine happening somewhere else where
go to Alabama.
Well, yeah. I mean, different places have different cultural norms. And the norm here is that if you're not a medium or a psychic or a meditator, you know, what are you doing here?
Okay. I think that's enough. We have to call it time of death.
Oh, you know,
I gotta say something though, Dr. Raiden, I swear your name sounds like a comic book character to me, like, or a video game, like Dean Raiden. It's something like Henry Pyme or Reed Richards. It's got a feel like that to it. Just the cadence of it.
Right.
Oh, you already knew that. Never mind.
Oh, yeah. That's why I like Jeff's work so much, because you can kind of live as an archetype after a while. You see, like, you're a character in a play that's being written.
Right.
And so some of it is your own free will, but how much of it is it really?
Right. I don't know.
And by the way, like, don't think about these things too much, because it'll hurt your brain.
Yeah.
So, you know, just like let it go by.
But people like you and Jeff make me feel okay. Like, I'm not a freak. It's okay.
It's all okay. Yes.
May we use the end? So the recorder's just been going. Can we put this in our member section, the past the 42-minute mark?
Sure, as long as they remember to not take it too heavily, because it will hurt their brain.
Yes. you're really good about that, as far as saying, you know, some of the stuff is, if you're not stable, it could be dangerous.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we get many, many phone calls and people who are in distress because they are experiencing these things and they want it to go away. In fact, that's the majority of the calls that we get. So I've learned the hard way that many people are on that schizotypey end of the scale where they're right next to psychotic and normal. And if you flip-flop from one to the other, it is not comfortable at all.
Hmm. All right, well, let's not go there.
Right. Stay away.
All right. Well, you have a lovely evening, it's we'll chat again sometime. Yeah.
Very good.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.